Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back, and it is now or never. And if I could invoke some action upon you, one of those things would be to try to take faith and try to act in faith, not just having prayer, but once you're done, you got to get involved. We need all hands on deck. We need all hands on deck because we are in a final battle for our Constitution. Just because Trump is president does not mean we are going to save ourselves from this condition that we're in. So anyway, we've got Tammy with us. And hello. Did I not cover all three of the obligatories? The debt is fraud. I didn't cover that one. Okay, so we finished the Constitution, and actually we did it a little less than 2 months. And though I think there's probably a lot of deep dives and rat holes we went into, I think that it was helpful.
Just a little bit.
Yeah, but I'm hoping that all of that was helpful.
Yeah, good. I think so.
Good. At least it gives you a more thorough insight to the Constitution. And all of these little gears or these little teeth of how the gears mesh and all of that, how it kind of works, what it means, and so forth. So what we're going to dive into, because we kind of covered government kicking off from the cod fishery bounties as well as the Assumption Act and the Bank Act and the Whiskey Rebellion and those things. Now we're actually going to cover, because we started covering this right before the Constitution. Folks, these are the most critical documents that anybody that wants to understand what do we do when government behaves badly. Now, the reason why, because most people today really look at the banks and these things that the corporations that the government is doing is the big evil. Thomas Jefferson and James Madison, though they saw the banks in that day doing things that it didn't have the constitutional authority to do, they didn't view it as an attack against the people in the states. It was an innocuous violation in their paradigm. Why was that? Because they weren't creating, at least they weren't aware of any of the shenanigans that Hamilton may have been doing or initiating, other than the fact that he was using the principles of implied powers. They were unaware of this idea that Hamilton was establishing a direct perversion of the federal court systems that you and I discussed, Tammy, prior mm-hmm. to going into the Kentucky resolutions, where we kind of examined Hamilton's actions while the Constitution was being ratified, the letters that he was sending back and forth to Madison and himself as they were communicating, and how he literally, once the Constitution crossed the finish line, he started injecting articles into the Federalist Papers. And they were pretty meaty articles regarding the judiciary and how the judiciary could assume full control over the Constitution and be able to, you know, make it putty in its hands. Now, Madison uses the term, and when we get into the Virginia report, the report of the Virginia resolutions by Madison, I think he uses the word putty. That the Constitution becomes putty in the party's hands because it is theirs. It is their creation, and it is theirs to change and form as they see fit. However, Hamilton put that putty into, or this perceived putty into the Supreme Court and showed them how they could create the paradigm that they had putty control, if that makes sense. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right, so when I look at Hamilton, I think that Hamilton, even though he, you know, he wasn't a perfect man. None of us are. I don't really think that he was really trying to do the evil doings. Excuse me, the evil doings that what he did ended up happening. In other words, I think he was really trying to do what he thought was really good government for America. I also think that he was really serving Britain. I think that there's more evidence that he was a spy than there is that he was, you know, not a spy. I can't prove that because the type of documentation that is, you know, identifies him as a spy isn't something that was really outed. I mean, it's one thing if we can go through the British archives and find out that, yeah, they were paying Hamilton. That, you know, Hamilton was on the take. We have a Canadian document that actually, you know, accuses or makes the insinuation that he was a spy number 7. So as nice as that one, does this make sense? As nice as it is to have a document that kind of alleges these spies for Britain, it doesn't seal the deal. And getting those documents out of Britain, because they're the ones that would have it. Mm-hmm. They're the ones that would have had those communications. And the question is, and 9 times out of 10, evil organizations tend to keep those types of things. Because it's a point of bragging. Look at what we did. We were able to do this. Anyway, so the Kentucky resolutions became a real, or I should say, the Alien and Sedition Acts were such a real perceived threat by Madison and Jefferson, because here the people were now going to be controlled and conscripted to laws that were violations of the Constitution. This was literally going to affect people, where the bank and some of the other things that they were doing wasn't really, at least they didn't see, you know, the threads and the greater webbing of the macro view as we see today. You know, hindsight always being 20/20. So they felt so moved that they had to take a stand, and they had to use, if you want to call it hyperbole, that's fine. But they had to use the rhetoric necessary to help motivate people, because they understood history. They understood that these were the types of acts that would put a nation on a path of peril. And so when we're looking at this, now, first off, the people of the time, such as the Virginia legislature, never knew that this document, the Kentucky Resolutions of 1798, were penned by Thomas Jefferson. This was the big secret between Jefferson, Madison, and maybe one or two other people. It was a huge secret because he was the vice president. And this new Alien Sedition Act made it impossible for him to actually take a stand against that act and the government. He said, you can't criticize us. You can't do these things, or you will go to jail. So he had to kind of hide, because he knew that at this point in time, his relationship. So here's an interesting thing. In those days, they actually, because it was a popularity contest and not a ticket, in those days, you actually had two opposing sides in the vice president and the presidency. Adams, at this point in time, and Thomas Jefferson weren't friends anymore. As a matter of fact, their friendship was being strained already. And when Thomas Jefferson, in the 1796 election, when it was tied, Thomas Jefferson gave a noble gesture of saying, you know what, I concede and basically recognize that Adams has won this election. I think that the proper thing that Adams should have done would have said, no, I concede. And as a matter of fact, you know, because we couldn't come up with an answer, I don't want you to do that. Let's actually come up with who the real winner is. And so have do it by casting a new vote, a new ballot, because that would have probably solved the problem. But because Jefferson was gracious and Adams was less than gracious because he just felt he deserved it. He was the former vice president, and he should be is like the prince heir. He felt
so they that, got it. They got an equal amount of electoral votes.
Yes, it was a tie vote.
Wow!
And instead of doing recounts and rechecks, when they came, the numbers came first. Thomas Jefferson was gracious, and he stepped aside. Now John Adams just accepted it like that, like he was entitled. And I'm making these presumptions because I really wasn't there, and I don't know those motivations, right? But bottom line, right, what Adams didn't do was Adams didn't go, no, we need to find out who really won. If there was a clear winner, we need to know. If not, then we really should actually do a revote. But Thomas Jefferson was trying to be gracious. And it didn't work out well because from that point forward, John Adams became a little tyrant because John Adams was a hothead. I mean, he was one of those old codgers that you couldn't tell him anything. He was not an objective, open-minded guy. He may have been objective and open-minded in his earlier years, but as he became president, he started making comments and statements that were really out of line for the president. Like one of the comments he said was, because everybody likes repeating this, that the United States is not a Christian nation. Well, actually, every state in the Union at the time were Christian. They had a Christian state-sponsored church. All 13 colonies had Christian state-sponsored churches. So when you look at the amalgamation, the entire, you know, glumfry, the entire wad of the states that were there, they were all Christian. How could he say that this was not a Christian nation? Because the federal government did not delineate and did not establish a church and did not have the capacity to operate on any religious matter. So he was only speaking of the federal government, but not the nation. The federal government was a service government. And so a lot of people, they didn't have a clue. They just thought that this was a good experiment to get them through the next few years. And as a matter of fact, Madison, in I think it was 1830, made the comment at the Virginia Convention that he hoped to see the Constitution last another 50 years, but he saw that as the new states to the West started joining the Union, that the interest would start changing. And that the need for the Constitution to be completely redone, or the division of the states would become, the tension between them, the interest of the East versus the West and so forth, would literally divide the nation. He didn't think that the Constitution would go that much further. So just to be clear, these men didn't realize the divinity and how this was literally the playbook that the divine hand of providence, our creator, had for this world, for liberty. As a matter of fact, I say this a lot. If you've never heard me say this, I say that it is comical to think that our creator only wanted the people who lived in these latitude and longitude coordinates of this little segment of the earth, only these people could live free and have liberty in giving us a government and a document that guaranteed that. In other words, it flies in the face of the Creator, creating all of us and loving all of us. Why would he only give us favor for this period of time? And so it makes no sense to me. I don't think that he, was doing that. I think that this was his plan because he really was creating a non-theocracy to help go knock down the theocracies of the world because we were the only non-theocracy government. I mean, our states were theocratic, but the general government was not. all other states in the world were theocratic, and they were problematic as well. And so this is one of the reasons why, you know, they didn't trust the European nations, because they had too many problems in, you know, in their cultures that took a while to outgrow those things. And it's the same thing with Asia and so forth. So I just see that the world needed to actually watch this little experiment of liberty to say, wow, look at what that nation had done, you know, and that nation didn't have lots of gold. Let's remember that the nations south of us, Mexico and South America and Central America, those nations had piles of gold. Cortez literally, Spain and Portugal raped those nations, and they've had galleys filled with gold, gems, and so forth that they took back to the states of Portugal and Spain. They were one of the richest nations of the time because they had all this newfound gold. And look at them today of how bankrupt they are.
Yeah.
So, and we look at when we realize that those types of things actually cast a darkness over the land. When you rape and steal and do those types of things, you know, to for your own gain, like what they did, it really created a disease in their culture so that they became conscripted, and because they had all this money. They started retiring early, and they spent all this money. So what ended up happening? They became broke. What ended up happening, though, in America was we were the ingenuiters. We had, you know, the entrepreneurial spirit. We actually had people that wanted to go work. People wanted to come here and work and have an opportunity. And so we became, by the forces of economic, you know, powers, of religious powers, all these different things that were driving people to America, America actually was on this, I don't want to say steroids, but America was on this path that was really being bolstered up for enlightenment purposes, because people were really coming here in some cases for selfish reasons, but they were doing it because of this liberty, and they maintained this spirit of liberty, especially after the Civil War, when things really started moving, especially the West started opening up. Manifest Destiny was prior to the Civil War, but we started seeing that. As a matter of fact, the Manifest Destiny spirit, which we have not covered this year yet, that spirit was one that was akin to this heavenly gift that we were given this land, and they wanted to go out and stake claims to make sure that this great nation would be able to flourish and grow, and that's why they were taking all of this land to the West. Now, everybody makes, when you look at Manifest Destiny, that was a dark time in America, supposedly. But it's not as though we did anything in the similitude of Spain and Portugal, those two nations. If you look at what they did and how they treated the indigenous people, they raped and they actually created a whole new class of citizens south of us, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because you had the Spaniards, you had the Indians, and then you had the Mexicans, which was the mixed breed of that, because that's what they did. There was actually this term that was, you know, being used, and actually it was frowned upon by the laws of nations, that you weren't to do that. You weren't to create a new class of people or a new generation or a new culture, such as the Mexican culture. Now, today, the Mexican culture is something that is, you know, it's they're very proud about that culture, right? Right?
Yes, they are.
Yes, yeah. They are. They're very proud about that culture. The fact, now, I don't think that they're out there bragging that the fact that they were basically, they were created by this really dark, insidious practice of the Europeans. But never.
Yeah, I did not know that.
Well, I mean, but you did know that Mexicans were the mixture between the Spaniards and the Indians. You knew that. Everybody knew that, but they didn't realize that this forming of this culture, which really became the majority of the people in that area, in you know, south of us, that they relish in their culture, but everybody has these little claws, you know, bones in their closet. I'll just use that expression. And so anyway, when we look at how we started moving forward, and actually I want to get back to the resolutions, as we as a nation were moving forward, we were not focused on what the federal government was doing, and it should never have treated the Indians the way it did. They should have actually, by creating these encampments within the states or within the territories, they should have released that to the states. Now, what would have happened? What would have happened is there may have been a couple of states that would have treated them just as bad, if maybe worse. But I believe that the states would have saw the light, because I see this in the American people. I see this in the Civil War and after the Civil War, when the southern state in Louisiana, the state of Louisiana, when they massacred all of these black freemen that were at a political convention trying to, you know, work together in getting injected into politics in Louisiana. There were around 200 black freemen that were killed, massacred.
Wow.
Now, this is not taught in our education system. As a matter of fact, we're taught that one of the greatest massacres was in Oklahoma. But, I mean, that right there may have been a massacre or an infighting of this, you know, this racism that had been flourishing and growing in tensions in that location. But this was truly a massacre where people were all confined into one building, and they descended upon them like sitting ducks. They were all killed. That right there sent a message to the nation of how brutal some people in some of the states are. And the rest of the nation softened its heart and said, hey, if you read Kurt Lash's documents or his thesis, his doctorate thesis on, you know, the 14th Amendment, that became the mandate that America was not that people that did that.
Right.
And so all of a sudden, though, in response to that, you know, things started going backwards as they all started redefining the 14th Amendment, disparaging the 14th Amendment, and so forth. But anyway, now Thomas Jefferson, we've got less than a minute. Now Thomas Jefferson and James Madison felt at this point in time that the head that was rearing out of the federal government was going to be so tyrannical that this was absolutely unacceptable. And as a matter of fact, the words that they use are of such, I'll just say, of such emotions, or they're conveying such threatening concepts that, you know, they're trying to invoke the passions of these states for liberty to actually step in. So, let me just set the stage, because the Alien Sedition Acts were set and passed in July of 1798. Thomas Jefferson and James Madison coordinated, and we don't know what they said or how they did this, but Thomas Jefferson wrote this and sent this off to Kentucky. In the interim, James Madison was preparing himself. After November 10th, he was preparing himself to go down to Richmond, and he was in Richmond. He was not a part of the legislature, nor was he a part of Congress. He traveled, stayed with friends. I mean, these guys did this at their own expense. I mean, today, you know, buy my book, and it's all about, you know, making money off of all of this. But these guys went down there, and Madison was kind of waiting for this document to come in so that when the document came in, they were going to be able to respond in kind. And they were basically applying the old age of the two-man theory. So we'll get into the two-man theory, and then we'll dive into this and then do the highlights on this so we can move forward. So we'll be right back after this short promo. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so as we dive into the Kentucky resolutions, one of the things that, like I said, Madison was already positioned in Richmond, and this was basically signed by the Kentucky legislature November 10th, the birthday of the Marine Corps. And so as this went out, just remember that when we dive into the resolutions of Kentucky or of Virginia, it was less than 2 months for them to sit down, digest what Jefferson sent, and actually publish their resolution. So Thomas Jefferson, if I remember correctly, started working on this in October. He, I think, put it in a writer's hands in the end of October, and it got there, and they deliberated on this. And I think there was a little bit of hoodwinking that we need to do this quickly. And so everybody just said, hey, don't ask questions. We just need to do this quickly. There was one person in the Kentucky legislature, John something, not Bingham, but I think it starts with a B, Buchanan, something like that, that actually didn't like the language of this and made, I will just say, significant changes in his own version, but that was never promulgated. In other words, what was promulgated was this, what was sent out to the other states was this, and what this gentleman brought forward at the end of November was the reason why many people looked at, because there were other writings of this resolution, because if you go to Avalon.org, or I should say the Avalon Yale school site, .edu, I think, Yale.edu, the Avalon Project, you'll find these documents, and they emboss the top of these as draft. In other words, if it's a draft, then it didn't go out. And they say that the 1799 resolutions were the final, but they were the subsequent and following resolution to this. So when we get into the 1799 resolutions, we're going to see clearly that the 1799 resolution is in response to the state's receipt of this resolution. Does that make sense? So the reason why the education system, the progressive education system, wanted to label this as draft, they wanted to create this dark cloud over this document to say, oh, it's draft. It never was finalized. What you're reading isn't important. This is a draft. And that's not true. It's a mislabeling and it's a mischaracterization by Yale. But don't be surprised that they tried to do this. And as a matter of fact, this is one of the few documents that I found that they've actually done this and they're trying to get away with that. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, they know what is their kryptonite, and they try to disparage, they try to downplay and marginalize those things that can do damage to their work. So that kind of helps, I think, highlight how important these documents are. Because these documents literally create the constitutional law argument of what has to happen when the federal government operates outside of its delegated powers. Okay, so now I'm going to stop talking, and this is where Tammy's going to earn her keep. So go ahead and read, and let's go ahead and read to the first semicolon, the first highlighted blue part.
Okay.
Just read that part.
Okay. Resolved that the several states composing the United States of America are not united on the principle of unlimited submission to their general government.
Right there. But that, right there. Oh, okay. That's the semicolon, the first blue part. So he's basically laid it out there. We are not united on being submissive to this general government on unlimited power. Just saying it differently. Yeah. Shot across the bow. We are resolved that you are limited. So go, what's the next step? Go ahead.
But that by a compact under the style and title of a constitution for the United States and of amendments thereto, they constituted a general government for specific purposes, delegated to the government certain definite powers, reserving each state to itself the residuary mass of right to their own self-government.
Okay. So right there, he's basically saying you're limited and defined. In other words, he's basically putting this, you know, I'll just say he's creating this view that this Constitution is a limited and defined power of attorney. We've only delegated to you very specific things. And all things that we haven't given to you, we retain those things. Go ahead.
Yeah, we didn't give you general powers over everything.
That's right. Very specific powers. So go ahead.
And whatsoever the general government assumes undelegated powers, its acts are unauthoritative, void, and of no force. Yep. That to this compact, each state acceded as a state and is an integral part, its co-states forming as to itself the other party.
Yep. That go ahead.
Okay. That the government created by this compact was not made the exclusive or final judge of the extent of the powers delegated to itself.
Right there. Okay, so now we see that they've created, actually he lays this out, that when government assumes undelegated powers, these acts and whatever it does is unauthoritative and should be void and of no force. What he's talking about is language for nullification. That to this compact, each state acceded as a state, as the integral part, and co-states forming into itself as the parties, that the government created by the compact cannot be the exclusive or final judge. So right there is the language that is needed to be grasped, that the federal government cannot be the final judges of the extent of their power delegated to itself. So that means that somebody else has to have that power. But what he does is before he finishes that thought, he wants to make sure that he, you know, pokes the beast one more time by saying the following. Go ahead.
Since that would have made its discretion and not the Constitution, the measure of its powers.
There you go. So that's the next step. So in other words, the poking of the beast says, if you actually had the ability to just make up your own powers, then you're no longer abiding by the Constitution. You're just making it up as you go along. You're using your discretion to determine what you want to do instead of operating within the confines of the Constitution. Okay? So now the last part. Go ahead and read that.
But that as in all other cases of compact, among powers having no common judge, each party has an equal right to judge for itself as well of infractions as of the mode and measure of redress.
Okay, that's fine. So what he just wrote here was this last part. He's basically putting it out that the Kentucky has judged for itself that what the federal government is doing is absolutely wrong, and it's communicating to itself. It's not acting like we're going to null and void this, and you know, you guys are on your own. We're, you know, we're just not going to abide by this. What this is it's again, there's a lot of spin. There's a lot of passion being thrown. You know, it's a good curve to the ball that he's throwing here. But he wants to make sure that, one, that the states aren't in this compact, you know, allowing it to be ruled by this little creature. He's not, and he goes on to, you know, make all these different arguments, and that they're not the final arbiters, that the parties are, and they have to make they have to make the decision. Now, first, each state has to make its own decision whether it wants to stay in the union or not. Because when the Constitution is violated, now, actually, what I'm going to do, because I've never done this before, but I think that it's important to bring up, because Jefferson is the authority on this. And so when we look at the Federalist Papers, let me see if I can find the F Papers, because I think I've got them right here. Let me see. F Papers, Federalist Papers 49. So Federalist Paper 49 is when Madison is dealing with the Anti-Federalists talking about conventions. Now, when you read this, this starts off, this is Federalist Paper 49, and this is Madison writing, because in the previous Anti-Federalist Paper, they brought up Jefferson's book, because Jefferson in 1783 wrote a book called The State of Virginia. And so, notes on the state of Virginia, I'm sorry. And actually, Madison quotes this, and he actually takes quotes out of this book. Because they were quoting this, Madison comes back and clarifies what they were trying to say, because they were basically trying to say that, you know, each individual state on its own, you know, would be able to, you know, determine whether they were going to abide by things or not. So, this is critical, because the concept of single state nullification, which we'll get to later, is a perversion of what they were trying to do. That the states first had to decide whether they were going to stay in the union or not. Now, this is what Federalist 49 states. The author of the, quote, Notes on the State of Virginia, close quote, Thomas Jefferson, quoted in the last paper, in other words, the last Anti-Federalist paper, has subjoined to that valuable work the draught of a constitution which had been prepared in order to be laid before a convention expected to be called in 1783. In other words, he's given the backstory that this thing was kind of written in the preparation for this constitutional convention of 1783 by the legislature for the establishment of a constitution for the Commonwealth of Virginia. He doesn't say Virginia, but just for that Commonwealth. The plan, like everything else from, or the plan, like everything else from the same pen, marks a turn of thinking, original, comprehensive, and accurate, and that the more worthy of attention, as it equally displays a fervent attachment to a republican government and an enlightened view of the dangerous propensities against which it ought to be guarded. One of the precautions which he, Thomas Jefferson, on which he appears ultimately to rely on the palladium to the weaker departments of power against the invasions of the stronger, is perhaps altogether his own and is intimately relates to the subject of our present inquiry, ought not to be overlooked. His proposition is, quote, that whenever two of three branches of government, because at this point in time, Virginia was creating three branches of government. They were dividing, you know, this legislature to create a governor, a judiciary. For the most part, they already had these things at the state level. So putting these things at the federal level was almost like it had never been done before, but it just, it made sense because it was a safer application of dividing the magistrate and having the representatives hold the massive power. But anyway, he goes in and says, that whenever the two or three branches of government shall concur in opinion, each by the voices of 2/3 of their own number, that a convention is necessary for altering the Constitution, here's the kicker, though, or correcting breaches of it, a convention shall be called for this purpose. So in other words, they were talking about using a convention in dealing with overreach. Madison pointed out, and this is highlighted, I highlighted this part, that a convention is necessary for altering the Constitution or correcting the breaches of it. So in other words, you had two types of conventions. You had a convention, which is the Article 5 convention, in altering the Constitution. Is there any language in the Constitution that creates a convention of states where they deal with the breaches thereof? No. They only talked about the mode of making changes to the Constitution. But clearly, there is a divide. There is the convention for altering, and a convention for, and these are capitalized words, correcting breaches of it. A convention shall be called for the purpose. Now what we're looking at with this thing we call the Kentucky Resolutions is we're actually looking at this concept. Hey, the Constitution's being breached. They're doing something they don't have the authority to do. And Thomas Jefferson said, we need to convene into a convention. They're not calling for an Article 5 convention here. We're going to go through this, and you'll realize that not once do they say, we've got to address the Constitution and change it. Not at all. The Constitution is not the problem. The government assuming powers is. So if the government is assuming powers because there's a problem within the Constitution, then it does merit this idea of changing the Constitution so those parties can't assume those types of powers, putting safeguards in. If the Constitution is the problem, you convene a convention to change it. If the Constitution is not the problem because government is assuming powers not delegated, everything that they're doing is not delegated to them, then those are clear breaches, and it's not about convening a convention at all in amending or touching the Constitution. This convention that Jefferson was proposing is actually the convention of judging and holding them accountable. What we're seeing is this is the actualizing.
A convention for redress of grievances.
There you go. It's what you just read. Correct. The measure of redress. How are we going to fix the problem? In other words, and Madison talks about, because we talked about the putty, Madison will bring that up in the report. So let's go ahead and dive into the next paragraph. Because this, we're going to jump into this, and then we're going to skip over the rest, because we already read all of this. But we have to start off with these key things. So go ahead, and let's start off with two, and let's just read the red, and then I'll dissect it after that.
Okay. Resolved that the Constitution of the United States, having delegated to Congress a power to punish treason, counterfeiting the securities and current coin of the United States, piracies and felonies committed on the high seas, and offenses against the law of nations, and no other crimes whatsoever, and it being true as a general principle in one of the amendments to the Constitution, having also declared that the powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, not prohibited by it to the states, are reserved to the states respectively or to the people.
Right, so here we've got Thomas Jefferson identifying what has been delegated to the federal government regarding crime and the jurisdiction over crime, that only these four types of crimes does the federal government have jurisdiction over. Therefore, when we look at the four crimes, only two of those crimes are pertaining to crimes within the United States. The piracies on the high seas, or piracies and felonies on the high seas, that's outside of the demarcation. High seas is outside our territorial waters, where we claim that is our water. In other words, high seas means we're out in no man's land. So in other words, those crimes are not committed within the United States. The next one is crimes committed, offenses against the laws of nations, which means that we're committing a crime on some other nation's land or property. or within their jurisdiction, crimes against the laws of nations, whether it be that individual nation or the laws of nations in whole, such as it could be out on the seas as well, doing and acting, with another nation which would be violating the laws of nations. The whole point of that being in, those two things being in Article 1, Section 8, is for ensuring that the federal government can protect the citizens when they're being scarfed up into these foreign courts. This is why they took jurisdiction and basically was to protect citizens, not to subjugate them, to protect them from the evil influences of foreign states and courts and international courts. So go ahead and read the last half.
Hey, hold on. I got to find out where I was at.
You just read the red. So therefore,
the red part. Okay. Therefore, the Act of Congress passed on the 14th day of July, 1798, and entitled an act in addition to the act entitled an act for the punishment of certain crimes against the United States, as also the act passed by them on the day of June 1798 entitled an act to punish frauds committed on the Bank of the United States, and all other acts which assume to create, define, or punish crimes other than those so enumerated in the Constitution are altogether void and of no force, and that the power to create, define, and punish such other crimes is reserved and of right, appertains solely and exclusively to the respective states, each within its own territory.
Okay, so in other words, the federal government just can't make making up crimes. And here's the interesting thing, because he kind of laid this out over the bank without revisiting it, that the fact that they even have a bank is unconstitutional. These were implied powers. And the fact that they're coming along and saying, hey, you can't commit fraud against our bank. You know, you can't, you know, play any shenanigans with our bank. We're going to punish you if you do. Bottom line, he's basically saying that we have to amend the Constitution if you're going to create law and have full jurisdiction over these things, period. Because those types of things weren't enumerated. The fact that they enumerated property, the fact that they enumerated powers, the fact that they enumerated crimes and their jurisdiction over these specific crimes means that those were the only things delegated. If it's not delegated, then it's reserved to the states and or the people respectively. That's what the 10th Amendment did. And so when they came along and said, oh, well, surely we created a bank, you know, where they implied the powers. It wasn't constitutionally done. And then they say, well, you know, we have a right to protect ourselves and our interests. Now they're making, so this is how one lie or one fraudulent act creates more and more and more. It's called the chain of tyranny.
Yeah.
Okay. So what he does from this point on, because what he starts doing here is the audit. An audit is where you go through the laws in contrast to the contract or the acts of this entity in contrast to the powers or those things enumerated, those things delegated to that entity in the compact. So this is why these next several paragraphs that we're going to just skip over are where he actually creates these paradigms, or I should say paradigms. He fulfills the need of the audit, because you got to go through every law with a fine-tooth comb and identify how they have actually violated the Constitution. And so when we read through 6 and 7, I'm just going to skip over those because we kind of talked about these before. And he talks about the judicial power and so forth. What really is important is going into the 8th article or the 8th resolution. But the one part, let's go into, you see above the 8th resolution, it's like 6 lines up, it says Constitution. That words meant by that instrument, just go ahead and start there.
Okay. That words meant by the instrument to be subsidiary only to the execution of limited powers ought not to be so construed as themselves to give unlimited powers, nor part to be so taken as to destroy the whole residue of that instrument. That the proceedings of the general government under color of these articles will be a fit and necessary subject of revisal and correction at a time of greater tranquility, while those specified in the preceding resolutions call for immediate redress.
There you go. So in other words, the whole point of these resolutions is to identify the problems and to force the federal government into redressing them or fixing them. Now is the shot across the bow. So let's go ahead and read this blue part first.
In the eighth?
Yes, correct.
Okay. Resolve that a committee of conference and correspondence be appointed, who shall have in charge to communicate the preceding resolutions to the legislature of the several states.
Okay, so what he just said was that they, all the states, need to create a committee of conference and correspondence. This is what created the Continental Congress and the move to the Declaration of War. In other words, when the states started convening the committees of correspondence, they quickly led to creating what they called the Continental Congress and what they called the Articles of Association, where they basically came together under this charter or under this agreement, the Articles of Association, that they would pull together their resources to stand up against the king. In other words, he's saying, states, we need to pull together and pull our resources together and stand up against this creature we created that's acting without authority. Go ahead.
Right.
Read the next one.
To assure them that this commonwealth continues in the same esteem of their friendship and union which it has manifested from that moment at which a common danger first suggested a common union. That it considers union for specified national purposes, and particularly to those specified in their late federal compact, to be friendly to the peace and happiness and prosperity of all the states.
Okay. So he's basically trying to create the warm and fuzzy, hey, we're all in this together, and that we all need to work together in fixing this problem. So now he kind of speaks in a contractual, go ahead, a little force here, go ahead.
That faithful to that compact, according to the plain intent and meaning in which it was understood and acceded to by the several parties, it is sincerely anxious for its preservation. That it does also believe that to take from the states all the powers of self-government and transfer them to a general and consolidated government without regard to the special delegations and reservations solemnly agreed to in that compact is not for the peace, happiness.
I apologize. So we're going to have to, I thought you could have got that in, but my bad, because that is a mouthful. So we'll pick it up with the red when we come back on Tuesday. But folks, these documents are on the academic source documents on Reclaiming the Republic. We would like you to read along as we go through. I'm G.R. Mobley, Reclaiming the Republic. We need your help. God bless.
Listen to my show, Reclaiming the Republic. Then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.